Namaste and welcome to a very special episode of the Bharatvartha podcast. We're privileged to have with us Amish Tripathi and Bhavna Roy, who are the authors of a fascinating book titled Dharma, Decoding the Epics for a Meaningful Life. Amish ji is perhaps India's best known and most loved author. He's also the director of the Nehru Center in London. We hosted him on the podcast last year, where we spoke about his book Suhail Dev, which is another fantastic read. Welcome, Amish ji. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Bhavna ji qualified for the Indian Administrative Services after graduating in psychology from Mumbai University. Having trained partly at the LBSNAA, she quit and then first worked as a volunteer in a school for special children. She's also tutored secondary and higher secondary students in software engineering. She also happens to be Amish ji's dear sister. Welcome to the podcast, Bhavna ji. Pleasure to host you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Pleasure is all mine.
Fantastic. So to begin with, I was talking about this to Srivatsa earlier as well. This book is pretty different. Amish ji, your books have a reflective quality to it anyway. But I think in this book, the format and the style really aid that reflection. And there's a certain profundity that is there in this book. I'm curious, how this book came about and, what was it like writing with Bhavna ji as well? What are the different perspectives that you brought to this book?
Let me just give a brief on the book itself. And then I think Bhavna Didi will be very well placed to speak of how we brought the book together. She says it very well. All my fiction books, you're right. There are two steps to it. Step one is the philosophies that we want to convey. And step two is the story, which works as a wrapper to convey those philosophies. In the way, like most storytellers, at least the ones who are rooted in India, will tell you, the model for all of us rooted Indian authors for our stories is either our Itihasas, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, or the tales of our Puranas, or the Katha Sarit Sagar. These are the models which we tend to follow. So in terms of, my fiction books, the model that I tended to follow is our Itihasas and Puranas, where the story is essentially a wrapper for the philosophies that we want to convey. I've written non-fiction non-fiction book earlier as well, called Immortal India. That was more in the traditional Western non-fiction style, where I would, it would be short articles, but with like a premise and me building up that premise. This is our first, non-fiction book, which actually follows the traditional Indic styles. And those who follow the Indic style of non-fiction, the role model is obviously the Upanishads, right? Which is very different from the way Western nonfiction books are written. Western nonfiction books are always that an author will state what his hypothesis is, what case he wants to build. And the book is essentially a means to build that case, right? So sometimes it can be written as a textbook, sometimes it can be written as narrative nonfiction, but it's very clearly that, right? This style. The problem with this style is often it leads to tribalism. Because every author will say, this is my side and I have to convince you of my side, right? Which also at its extreme leads to fanaticism, my side, your side. We see it in our TV panel debates. Sadly, India has also imported this Western approach. The Indian approach of philosophical discussions, scientific discussions, all of them were conversations. That's how the Upanishads are also structured, conversations. It's the author is not saying, this is my side. And my task is to convince you of my side. No. He says, these are the possible points of view in this subject. And there are characters who through conversation speak different points of view. Like how, Nachiketa and Dharmaraja in the Upanishads, Yajnavalkya and Maharishika Gargi and, they do in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. So they are conversations. Now, this we are actually following the Indic storytelling, Indic nonfiction style, where there are conversations and we present different points of view. And we are not being prescriptive like a traditional Western nonfiction book, that this is the right approach. My task is to convince you. No. Presenting different points of view. Now you think about it and see what appeals to you. So this is how this is. This nonfiction book is more in our traditional style. Now how this specific book came together, Didi, why don't you...
So we had begun this project really in 2013-14, very long time ago. Amish's three books had already come out in the market, Meloha, Nagas, and Vayuputra. We are typically big, fat Indian family, chatty, argumentative, philosophical, given to philosophy. I think the average Indian is given to, philosophical exploration. And this was an evening of conversation based on discussing the philosophies behind Amish's books till then. And somehow we veered towards a discussion on Murti Pujan, idol worshipping. It is a very interesting discussion. At the end of it, our brother Anish suggested to Amish and I, why don't we write a book on pure philosophy, extracted from Amish's universe as well as our ancient epics. Initially, I started working on them. And I wrote really 20 pages. I didn't write the 21st page. There were 20 pages. And I sent them to Amish. Now, Srivatsaji, you just said that you also are from Chembur. Amish is 8 years younger to me. He was born in Chembur. And, he's very deferential, very respectful. But he's also very forthright. And he said to me very respectfully, "Ki Didi, this is not readable. It's very, very theoretical. And it's really not happening." So I said, "All right, what should I do?" So he said, "Give it to me. Let me work on it." And really, then he infused it with his Amish magic. Because he created this wonderful family. A mother, father, a daughter and a son-in-law. The charming thing in this family is that, the main point and counterpoint, I wouldn't call it counterpoint, it's really Guru Shishya, is the father-in-law and the son-in-law. And of course, their wives are more than adequate accompaniments to the discussion. So he created this lovely family and suddenly my 20 pages had come to life. Because there were arguments, there were points, there were counterpoints, there were explorations. It and like Amish said, it's in our Upanishadic tradition. The beauty was infused by him. There was to and fro after that. And then really it was shelved. The project was shelved for 4 to 5 years because of personal reasons. COVID was an opportunity because Amish called me up and said, "Didi, why don't we start working on the project again?" Large parts of it was ready. Really, in during COVID times, it was the editing work, that was to be done by our wonderful editor Karthika, and it came to fruition.
I have my copies.
All of us, yeah.
Yeah, one of the most beautiful parts about the book is that every character holds his or her own, right? And you see that sense of balance. Everyone brings in something new in their perspective to the story. And nobody holds back as such. I mean, they do express their thoughts and feelings about certain things. I want to pick up on something the both of you talked about, which is that there are no right or wrong binaries. There is no black and white as such, right? And it's not trying to be prescriptive saying that, hey, this is what you have to do. It's more a treatise on action and consequence. Now, when you talk about these things in such a complex manner, how do you see that relevant in daily life as to, let's say an IT professional or whatever, how can he use some of these attributes in his daily life? And I was just curious about that, how it's relevant.
Yeah,
Question is to both of you. Anyone can answer.
If I can attempt it, but like I said, Didi is much wiser than I am, so she'll probably give a better answer on this. But maybe what I would say is that in daily life, you know, among the biggest sources of dissonance is the concept of one truth, right? Mm. And that one truth is even available to us human beings, which is not the Indian way. One truth is available only to the divine. No human being can know the one truth. We don't know it. How do we know that? We are still here. If we knew it, we would have got moksha. We would have got nirvana. What that does almost intrinsically, deeply, it makes you liberal. Because you respect multiple truths. If you see the way we Indians approach our belief systems at the core of our being, you know. And this is not just true of the way the dharmic religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism, which are the dharmic religions, but even Islam and Christianity, the way it's practiced in India. The concept of multiple truths allows us to have our own beauty and yet feel connected. Yeah. It's a very gentle string which kind of binds us all together. What that does in our daily life is we can work together a lot more easily. India is a country, often we don't get the scale of our country. We have more people than North America, Europe and Middle East combined. And we are a functioning country. In 1947, most conventional wisdom was that India would break up. But there is this string which holds us together. And that string is actually multiple truths. That there are, it's like in the north, we worship Lord Kartik too, right? But we see Lord Kartik as a bachelor god. So women don't enter Lord Kartik temples. But in the south, Lord Kartik is seen as he has two wives. So women do enter, you know, and pray out there. It doesn't cause any dissonance in India. You know, and like I've said very often, my mother, my sister in the north, they won't enter a Lord Kartik temple. In the south, they do. Okay, same individual. What does this do? It kind of binds all of us together, but without forcing anyone to convert. It's not that every rose, every flower has to become a rose. Otherwise, you'll go to hell for eternity, right? You can be a sunflower, you can be a rose, you can be a frangipani, you can be various different flowers and you're still tied together with this light string which holds us all together. That allows congregations, that allows working together among people with very different approaches. It is what makes Indians naturally such good managers of multinationals. Why is it that there are so many Indians at the top of vast multinational corporations which are also multicultural, various different, it's not easy to manage them, right? The Chinese have done as well as the Indians in the West economically, but how come you don't find as many Chinese CEOs as Indian CEOs? Because for us, this multiplicity just comes almost smoothly, and yet we're able to find a common connection that comes from our way of life,
yeah.
Right? And something that you find in the West, I've been living in the West, in the UK for so long, even the liberals out here, the so-called liberals, also believe in the one truth. That their path is the liberal path. Anyone who doesn't agree with their liberal path has to go to the metaphorical hell, you know, has to be cancelled out. And how's that liberal? You know, which is why even their leadership style becomes very you and me, you know, right. Very otherizing. I have to destroy the other one. Whereas with Indians, it doesn't come that way, right? And this is a very, very, very critical skill in today's world where we are forced to engage with cultures who have a radically different view of life than we do, right? So this is a critical, which is why Indians make such great CEOs.
Yeah.
Sorry, Didi.
Sanatan Dharma really is an adult approach to spiritualism. It is not prescriptive. And infantilizing. Not that I'm demeaning that in any sense. All of us very often need a list of do's and don'ts, which is why we have parents and gurus and mentors and path givers. Having said that, the approach of Sanatan Dharma is really very, very adult. It's about action, consequences, and taking charge of your own, taking responsibility for your own actions. My husband used to say that the opposite of right is left, the rest is all context. Which actually is brought out in this beautiful story, which I will, you know, relate. It is from Ravan, you know, enemy of Aryavarta. And we have also used this story to delineate the subtlety of dharma in our book. The story is about an old, aged lion. Who you know, has been thrown away from his pride, and he's got these little children of his, and he's old, he's spent, and his children are hungry, and he's helpless. He spots one day a deer, a female doe, along with her children across you know, the grassland. And he says, all right, this is an opportunity to, you know, do my dharma and, you know, get some food for my children. And he starts, you know, he makes a dash running for this little family of this female doe and her children. As they start running, this family, there's this little runt of the deer family, this child, who starts falling behind. And the lion is really going for this little one now, because he's convinced, if not himself, and he'll certainly be able to feed his children that day. The mother deer realizes that this little child of hers is falling behind, and she starts slowing down. And she starts slowing down more and more and more, and allows her little one to move ahead. And then she comes to a halt. And she comes to a halt, and so does this lion. Because he's confused. And now he doesn't know what to do. Should he kill this magnificent mother who is sacrificing herself for the sake of her children? Or should he kill this magnificent mother and adhere to his dharma of feeding his children? Now, this is the conundrum of life. It is so often not a choice that you have to make between right and wrong, but right and right. Now, which right are you going to choose, and which right are you going to opt out of? Sometimes life presents you with a choice between wrong and wrong. And you've got to make, you don't have the third option of not choosing either. You've got to choose either one wrong or the other wrong. Which one will you choose? These are not easy questions to answer. And there is this lighthouse, this little, you know, dharmic lighthouse within all of us, because in Sanatan Dharma, you know, everything is divine. Divinity infuses, you know, every aspect. If you're material, you're divine. Pathar, you know, diamonds are divine. The sun is a magnificent example of divinity. And if we are able to tap into that divine light within us, we may be able to find guidance in making these tough choices in life.
Right.
And if I can just build a bit on what Didi said, often in the field of dharma, it's not about the action. It's the reasons for the action that are as important, you know, if not more important. So your intentions matter greatly. Your bona fides matter. So if the lion chose to kill the deer to feed his children, that is dharma. He's a father. He has to do it, right? But if he chose to, you know, to kill the deer just because he's just hunting for the pleasure of it, as many human beings do, that is adharma. If the lion chooses to leave the deer because he wants to gift life to a magnificent mother, that is dharma. But if he chooses to leave the deer because he's tired and he's sick of life and doesn't want to do his dharma of feeding his children, that is adharma. Same with the mother. If the mother sacrifices her life to save her children, that is dharma. Same action. But if she does, if she sacrifices her life because she is tired, because she doesn't want to fight life, because she says the hell with it, because she's a coward, that is adharma. Same action. Same action. But if the reasons are different, that's the difference between dharma and adharma. So often we have to think of our the reasons and our intentions a lot more, because then that leads to the consequential action later.
Right. Fascinating. So one thing I found in the book was, you know, there are so many different philosophies you've sort of connected, Aztec, Greek, Indian, and so on. But one thing I found common across all of this was the idea of karma existed, you know, in all of these. So I have two parts to my question. First is, you know, according to you, what is karma? And secondly, is it really possible to understand the concept of dharma without understanding karmic philosophy? Bhavna ji, maybe you can answer that.
Yeah, Didi should answer this.
Is it possible to understand dharma without understanding karma? Dharma is absolute. Dharma can exist in nothingness. Dharma does not need a counterpoint to exist. But once existence has come into being, once we have moved away from nothingness and creation has come into being, then there is karma. Because karma is movement. Any kind of movement is karma. If dharma is the spinal cord, the center of life, then karma is the movement which will take you either away from the center or towards that center. If karma is movement, then what exactly is movement? This is movement. Words are movement. Action in the world out there certainly is movement, but so is breathing. It's movement. It's karma. Thoughts in our head, they are karma. The feelings in our heart, they are karma. If I'm sitting here talking very correctly and very respectfully with the three of you, but my mind is in a state of chaos right now, and which is not reflecting in my words, or my emotions are in a state of distress right now, which is not reflecting in my external actions, I'm in a state of adharma. I'm in a state of scatter. Even if it is not reflected outside. So in that sense, there can be no karma without dharma. But dharma exists by itself, even in nothingness. As for the other streams of spiritualism that you talked about, Srivatsaji, the past 200 years really have been about religions of external, material life. These are religions. And really the Sanskrit equivalent for religions is panth. It's not dharma. Whereas the ancient streams of life, of spiritualism, were really about inner life, not just Sanatan dharma in our beloved India, but ancient Egypt, ancient Mesopotamia, ancient Greece, ancient Rome, ancient Japan, ancient Native Americans, Asian, Central Asians, ancient. They were all spiritual streams which were concerned with inner life, with spiritual pursuits. And they may not have had the word dharma, but they had the equivalent concepts. So, unfortunately, for the world, almost all of them have ceased to exist and are museum pieces and exist in academia and museums today. Our Sanatan Dharma managed to survive, and it's a vibrant lived experience even as we speak.
So one of the quotes that I found in the book that was really fascinating is what is good for the beehive is good for the bee. But if you look at, the world that we live in, we sort of privilege individual rights over sort of a collective responsibility that we hold to the society or even to the family to a certain extent, I feel. So Amish ji, how does it reconcile with, the current context?
You know, I think Didi had said this beautifully, that when we were discussing this philosophy, that often we have to be clear what beehive are we a part of. Right? And that defines how we react often. Often those who speak of pure individual rights at the cost of everything else are actually part of the beehive called globalists, right? Which is actually a separate culture. This is a separate global culture, may not necessarily be connected to the nation that they are living in. They may not be rooted. You know, if I look at myself, you know, what is the beehive I'm a part of? I'm a part of my family, right? That is the beehive that I'm a part of. I'm a part of the beehive of Lord Shiva worshippers. Right? I'm a part of the beehive of the Sanatanis, the Dharmic religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Jainism, Sikhism. I'm a part of this beehive. I'm a part of the beehive of Mother India. So everyone, regardless of the religion they follow, regardless of their background, regardless of the language, is my beehive, you know, part of my beehive. And yes, hopefully, you know, sometime all of us will reach the spiritual wisdom to see all human beings as a part of one beehive. Perhaps we are far away from that. I can't say I follow that right now, but maybe we'll reach, I'm sure we'll reach that stage also sometime. Then when we realize that that is what enlightened selfish interest should lead to, right? Because A, you will do what is in the interest of your beehive, but you'll also realize that while doing that, usually if you hurt yourself, if you're not going in your own interests, then you hurt the beehive as well. You have to remain strong to be able of being used of being of use to the beehive. So essentially what I'm suggesting is there's a balance, right? If it swings to either extreme, and one of the things that comes with dharma is the value of balance. If it swings on either extreme where you're so individualistic that you don't care at all about what happens to the beehive, which is happening in many Western countries, right? That is not good. It leads to loneliness, destruction of the community, destruction of traditions. And we're seeing the fallout of that. During the COVID pandemic, these societies have become weak and brittle. They don't know how to handle, you know, a crisis, a society-wide crisis like this, because they're all alone, right? Unlike in India, where you're never alone, right? There's a downside to that as well, you know. Your neighbors will interfere in your life. Everyone will, there's no privacy. You know, first time you meet someone, they'll say, "Bachche nahi hai, kyun nahi hai? Are yaar, tere ko kya lena dena hai?" Okay. But there is an upside to that as well, that you are not alone. Someone will always be there to help you, to look out for you. That gives the society strength. It makes it anti-fragile. It's one of the reasons I think India has done so well in the COVID pandemic, because we are not just dependent on the government. We help each other. We have traditions. We have community, right? So if you go too individualistic, that is not good. But if you go too much on the beehive and don't look at yourself at all, that is not good either, because then you surrender liberalism. And there are societies like that. You surrender women's rights. You surrender LGBT rights. It becomes hidebound. That's not good either. You have to find that balance, right? That is what makes it ideal. But every action that you do, the phrase that I would use is enlightened selfish interest, that it should be in my interest, but it should be in the interest of my beehive as well. If I'm writing, for example, a book which could, say, get me an award or get me more sales internationally, but is not in the interest of India, should I do it? I'm very clear, no, India is my beehive. No, I will not do it, right? But should I, you know, not try and, you know, build my own career, you know? No, how does that help? Unless I am of use to my country. And for that, I have to have my own strength as well. So again, balance.
Right.
Right. So Bhavna ji, I'll ask this question to you. In this book, there are two concepts that come out, dharma and swadharma. How are the two kind of related, you know, in context to what Amish just mentioned? If you could just explain that, it would be great.
The beehive concept, you're very right, Srivatsaji, can be actually related to Swadharma and Dharma. Because often we may misdefine what our Swadharma is. We may consider it Swadharma, but it's taking us away. Any definition of Swadharma that is taking you away from the central line of Dharma is misguided Swadharma. Now, how do you know? Because it is so difficult, you know. Let me skip into the beehive example to answer how do you know. Because ultimately, this is what life is all about, the search and the exploration. But what are your clues, you know, as to whether you're on the right path or the wrong path? In my teenage years, I was a very angry girl, very, very angry teenager. My, you know, brother will attest to that. Very difficult to live with. The beehive that I identified myself with was womanhood. I was very angry about the lot of women and about, you know, the rights of women. And sab ka sab, we know the, you know, entire trope. And the irony of it all was that my lived experience was, you know, I mean, the only thing it should have inspired in me is sheer gratitude, because I had wonderful parents. I had a comfortable life. I had wonderful brothers. I had parents who treated me, who was the girl child, with as much respect and, you know, the same set of rules as the three boys in the family. My lived experience as a female was actually, should not have aroused any anger with me, but within me. But I was angry about the lot of women. Now, as I entered, you know, my adulthood, I got married I began to live more deeply. Without even realizing it, very subtly, my beehive changed. And my beehive became my marriage, my family, my Sanatan Dharma, India. And it settled me. Now, how do you know your Swadharma is coming into line with Dharma? Is when your inner chaos recedes and begins to disappear. If you move towards harmony, you are calm, you become a positive person. If you're in a state of inner angst and you're in a state of anger all the time, then you are identifying yourself. It's a problem of identity. You're identifying yourself with the wrong beehive. And if you are moving towards harmony, it's a clue that you're beginning to, you know, your Swadharma is moving towards, you know, the center. These are clues. Let's take Kumbhkaran, for example. He was a deeply dharmic person. His Swadharma was loyalty to an adharmic elder brother. How did he deal with this? He never failed to show the mirror to his elder brother. He never let go of the opportunity to keep trying to bring his elder brother, you know, away from scatter. But at the same time, he did not turn his back on his brother, because that was his Swadharma. To always walk two steps behind his adharmic brother and yet be in, you know, live his life with awareness of his own actions. He was a deeply dharmic person whose Swadharma, I feel, was his consonance with Dharma, despite being loyal to an adharmic elder brother.
Right. The book also talks about how envy takes us away from the path of Dharma, and also the difference between wanting and having. Now, this is another, you know, really profound concept. You know, one can argue that the entire modern economy itself is built on envy. I wonder, Amish, if you could explain this a little further in detail.
I think Roshan, you've been very insightful in saying that the entire modern world is, in a sense, built on envy. Materialism is built on envy, keeping up with the Joneses.
Consumerism, yeah.
And I'm not deriding materialism to an extent. Right? There are benefits of it. The economic growth has reduced poverty to the lowest in human history. Middle classes lead lifestyles that that the royalty couldn't have lived 150 years ago. Per capita poverty is the lowest ever. Per capita hunger is almost gone from the world. You may have per capita malnutrition, but per capita hunger is reduced drastically, except in war zones and a few places, compared to how it was in most of the ancient world. Matlab, pehle to khana nahi milta tha, abhi khana milta hai, achha khana nahi milta hai. So there is dramatic improvements. I don't deny that. But from a spiritual perspective, the emotion that corrodes you the most is envy. It is perhaps the worst emotion. Even anger has purposes at times. Envy, you need to be very wary of that internally, and you need to stay away from those who are envious of you, because there is almost nothing positive in that emotion. It is corrosive, completely corrosive. And it doesn't lead to personal happiness, a sense of purpose, a sense of peace. You know, something that Sadhguru Jaggi Vasudev had said, which is so true, that yes, materialism has led to fantastic benefits, materially, right? To give the entire world material benefits, we are ripping Mother Nature apart. We are destroying nature. Animals are dying. Species are being wiped out at a rate which many scientists are actually calling ELE, extinction level event. We are doing all that, right? And we aren't even getting happiness out of it. What's the purpose? What's the point? Because someone else has bought a bigger TV, we buy a bigger TV, we put it up and you get that momentary pleasure, and the next moment you realize actually it doesn't give me any pleasure. Now, what's the next source of envy? It's just running on a treadmill like this repeatedly. Again, I am not saying jump to the other extreme and sab chhod chhad ke jungle mein chale jao. No, I'm not saying that. How do you get a sense of balance, right? And of course, the sense of materialism is good. Traditional Indian culture never said no to that. Artha is there as one of the four purusharthas. But it's not only artha. There's also kama, there's also dharma, there's also moksha. You should have all four. Unless you have all four, your life isn't meaningful. If it's only artha, it's only wealth, and which is being driven by envy, that's not good. So again, the point is, come back to balance. Enjoy materialism, but you must practice dharma as well. Dharma is beyond religion. It's above religion. Yeah, you must practice kama as well, all the sensual pleasures of life, and prepare yourself for moksha. Then you will lead a balanced life. If there's one thing that the last 1 year has taught so many of us, if we choose to learn, is that actually we need a lot less than we think we do. Right? And perhaps money can give you most pleasure when you actually give it to those who need it, when you do charity. And you do it quietly. No ego, no this thing on social media, no press releases, nothing. Do it quietly. As Vidur had said in the Mahabharata, there are two ways to waste money. One is by giving money to the unworthy, which is someone selling you things which you don't actually need. Or second, way of wasting money is not giving it to those who are worthy, which is doing charity.
Fantastic. One of the fascinating aspects of the book was the Yudhishthira 1 and Yudhishthira 2 theory, the whole transformation, right? You know, how he moves from someone who used to gamble and talks a good game, but does not really practice it. How important is action and not just words? You spoke about intent, but how important is action in the context of dharma and swadharma?
Didik?
Yeah, Bhavna ji, you can answer this.
In that sense, you know, once intent is in place, and how do you get intent into place? Because, you know, we create cover intentions, you know, we create acceptable intentions for our real intentions, because we all want to feel good about ourselves. So once you have, you know, got that conundrum in place, which is intentions, the thing is, words have to translate into action. Now, words are unable to translate into action when you do not see yourself. When you do not see yourself very clearly. The thing with Yudhishthir part one was he saw other people. He read them very clearly. He was a righteous person. And it isn't as if he misread the good and the not good. He saw the good and he saw the not good. What he didn't see is himself. The contradictions of his own mismatch between his righteousness and his action, which means he was really self-righteous, not so righteous. Because unless your words match your action, you are a bol bachchan, as they say, you know. Now, the thing is that in order for your words to translate into actions, you have to start seeing your own flaws. And you have to stop feeling so good about yourself. And you have to reach self-knowledge and then translate your words into actions. Become an example. Don't tell each other, other people how they should be. Become an example. And that is the change that Yudhishthir was able to make by self-understanding. I'll give you an example. Supposing a mother wants to teach compassion to her child. Now, one way is, let's think about this with an example. Let's say a mother is sitting at an airport with her, 7-year-old daughter. And there is a person across, an old person who's holding a sheaf of papers. And as, let's say I'm creating this, even as I'm speaking, as he gets up, the sheaf of papers go into the air. Now, that's an opportunity for the mother to teach compassion to her 7-year-old child. Now, option one is she tells her daughter that, beta, go help that auntie, you know, gather her papers. The second option is chiding her 7-year-old daughter. Beta, can't you see? You know, auntie's papers are all over the place. Come on, get up, go help her. The third option is mother just gets up and goes and starts picking up the papers. Chances are the 7-year-old daughter will follow her and also start picking up the papers. Now, which is the most effective example? You know, be the change that you want to see in the world. That's what Gandhiji said. Yudhishthir was able to make that shift. Embrace action. Now, once you embrace action, you have to ask yourself, what action? Because action can't be palliative action, assuaging action, appeasing action. It has to be dynamic, effective action. And Yudhishthir even embraced that when ultimately he understood that the great war has to end. And for that to happen, if I have to take a swim upon my soul and actually lie, you know, to see that, Dronacharyaji, you know, is removed from the battlefield. He does that. The earlier part one, Yudhishthir would have said, no, I will not, you know, I cannot lie. Because he was all words. But Yudhishthir, through self-understanding, through the troubles and tribulations that he faced, embraced true humility, which is always accompanied by action.
Yeah, I think one of the things Amishji also has said, I think on the previous podcast as well, is that children do not what their parents ask them to do, they do what their parents do. Right? Yeah. Roshan, what do you?
Yeah, yeah. I was also thinking about the part where you talk about obedience. Where obedience is not an excuse, I mean, it's used as an excuse to not do the right thing. And somehow, and I think we covered this earlier as well in the last podcast, Amishji, where we have this sense of passive culture that's just come in, right? Where chalta hai type of a thing. And I was wondering, you know, how does someone build that responsibility of actually sticking one's neck out and doing the right thing if, you know, if required, maybe going against the grain or going against a, you know, a recognized convention as such for the greater good?
That the thing that we have in modern India today, that every youngster has to be obedient. No, that's not what our ancients taught us. Was Lord Krishna obedient to Balram ji? He was a younger brother, was he? No. Was Lord Ram obedient? In fact, if you think about it, his father, you know, Emperor Dashrath, did not want Lord Ram to go. And Lord Ram knew that, right? In a way, he, you know, he said, I will disobey you to honor your word, right? Why? Because he thought that was dharma. So in our culture, what has always been at the heart of our way of life is dharma. And if following your elders' commands are in line with dharma, then you should follow your elders' commands. But if following your elders' commands leads you towards adharma, then it is your duty to question. Now you must, because you are speaking to your elder, you must be polite. You must be respectful. You must never be rude. You must never abuse this modern thing that's, you know, that's come in. And you see our ancient stories, and no one ever abuses. They will have anger. But that is not okay. Behaving disrespectfully is not okay. But that doesn't mean that you blindly obey and do something that is adharma. That is not Indian culture. It's true of one can give so many examples from the past. So I think that's a key lesson that we must learn. At the heart of our way of life is dharma. And even elders, when they want respect, they have to command it, not demand it, and command it through their actions. Their actions must be dharmic as well.
Right. Bhavnaji, one of the things you mentioned in the book is, you know, the difference between uncontrolled rage and anger, and how we can channel anger to achieve something positive, whereas, you know, rage can actually end up destroying us. So can you just, you know, talk about how, you know, we can channel anger positively and, you know, sort of attain our dharma or do the right thing?
Ideally, of course, one must gain mastery over one's challenging emotions, and anger is a challenging, not an inspiring emotion. Having said that, anger, we are all victims of anger. If we can learn how to channel anger, we can put it to use. How do we learn how to channel anger? The only way to learn how to channel not only anger but all our emotions, they are tools, is by learning to observe ourselves, understanding ourselves. Really, the only person we really live with every moment of our lives is ourselves. And if we are able to instill the ability to observe ourselves the way we observe others, then we will learn how to channel our emotions. And channeling is very important, because if there is anger within you, it must find an outlet. If there is grief within you, it must find an outlet. Even if there is envy within you, it must find an outlet. Because if these emotions do not find an outlet, then they turn to poison within you. And they can, over a period of time, embitter you and make you, a bitter or even a cruel human being. So channeling these emotions are very, very necessary. Even Plato talked about being able to channel anger. One can channel anger by, working to set, a wrong, right in one's family, in one's life, in one's society even. It can be a way of channeling. Ideally, though, one has to gain mastery over even anger, because the other day Amish had a beautiful session with Sudha Murthy ji, and she said something that really moved me. She said that poverty inspires me to help. Now, how beautiful is that? Because one would expect people to say that, poverty angers me to action. I want to do something about it. There was such a serene and calm expression on her face when she said, poverty inspires me. That is so much more positive. In the meantime, till you are able to achieve that stage, it's good to channel your anger and do something about poverty. Because if you don't even do that and let it fester within you, then it can transform into rage. And that will make you an ugly human being.
Yeah, so this has been a fascinating discussion. So many nuances and at such depth that you uncover these things in the book, and we're probably leaving out another 100 nuances that we could talk about, and that's probably best left to readers to discover these things by themselves. Again, Bhavnaji and Amishji, thank you so much for writing this book. I think does a fantastic job of making things relevant to our the people of today, right? So before we leave you, one final question. Again, we're coming off of a really tough year, and things seem to be getting better as we enter this new sort of era, right? 2020s. What are you most optimistic for from an Indian perspective?
Let me use the example of an example that all of us saw and enjoyed, the cricket series in Australia.
Yeah.
Is this going to be a tough decade? I think that is almost a given. Right? This is a decade where there will be a lot of changes. My sense. 2020 was just a precursor for various things that will happen. This is a time of change. And as our ancestors have told us, times of change, of massive global changes, are usually accompanied with a lot of uthal puthal, a lot of chaos, a lot of tough times. Who are the people who emerge victorious at the end of this? They're not necessarily the ones with you need to have basic talent, but they're not necessarily the ones with the most talent. They're the ones who are the grittiest, who are the toughest. All our bowlers put together, my statistics could be slightly wrong. All our bowlers put together before the start of this series, before the start of the last test match, didn't have more than 13 wickets. Going up against the bowling attack, which was almost, the Australian bowling attack, which was almost universally acknowledged as the best bowling attack in the world, perhaps the best in, one of the best in Aussie history, right? Our top batsman wasn't there. Many of our top batsmen had got injured. Many of our top bowlers had got injured, right? And yet we won. And what does that show? Grit and toughness. We will not surrender, right? We will keep fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting. And yet at the end of it, did you see Ajinkya Rahane's expression when he came?
Yeah.
Calm, serene, that tough steel inside, but no like anger, wasting energy all over the place. No, calm, serene, almost like, Raj Rishi. The fury and rage of, the toughness of a Raja, but the calmness of a Rishi. I think India is showing that character. I think Mother India is showing it the way they've handled the COVID pandemic. See the chaos in so many other parts of the world, so many more developed parts of the world who have so many things going for them. Tons of money, infrastructure, everything. What do we have? We are still a poor country on a per capita basis. But look at the toughness and grit we have shown in 2020. This decade will be difficult. Right? There will be a time of intense change. I genuinely believe, however, that this will be Mother India's decade. We will emerge far stronger from this than most other countries in the world because we are showing the qualities that are needed for this. Toughness, grit, a never-say-die attitude, and yet the ability to keep that sense of balance. You know, because when you're swinging on extremes is when you go completely mad. Like just a simple thing like mass has become a political issue in the West. Whereas in India, we realize, yeah, it's good for us and we are the most rebellious people here. But so many people are wearing masks. We are doing things that need to be done. So that's what I see happening, which is why I am such an India optimist.
Fantastic. Bhavnaji, some final comments from you and after that we can end.
I'm an India optimist. I'm also an optimist on Sanatan Dharma. We live in very complex times. This social media revolution it knocks you off your feet. Douglas Murray, the British author, has said that this communication revolution of the social media is going to reduce the invention of the printing press to being a footnote in human history. That is a phenomenal statement to have made. Because the social media is such a humongous challenge of, human beings talking to themselves and talking to the whole world at the same time. Life no longer has the space for making mistakes, for being young and foolish. Because you do young and foolish things today on social media and they're going to remain forever. These are not footsteps in sand anymore. They're footsteps in forever, you know. So almost the right of, you know, the early youth to make mistakes, to learn through trials and tribulations, reflections has been taken away. And now it's like you're living life in a Truman Show in so many, you know, simultaneous Truman Shows all the time. Life has become so complex that really we need an adult approach to understanding how to live, not just the tools and the skills to be successful in life. How do we live our inner life, our inner drama? And the answer to that is ancient approaches to wise living. Sanatan Dharma is a very fully fleshed out candidate in that effort. So I'm very hopeful.
Wonderful. That's a wonderful note to end the podcast on. Thank you so much, Bhavnaji, and thank you, Amishji, as well. Hope you will write many more books that will impact all of us. Really, such a pleasure hosting you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely lovely. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in. This podcast was brought to you by the team at Bharat Vartha. If you liked this podcast, then don't forget to share, subscribe, and rate us on your favorite platforms. We're available on Anchor, Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, Breaker, YouTube, and a host of other platforms. We started Bharat Vartha to facilitate long-form discussions on politics, policy, and culture. We don't necessarily endorse anything that was said in this episode. If you do wish to offer us any feedback on the content or anything else, do reach out to us on social media or get in touch with us on our website, www.bharatvartha.in. The links are in the description below. Thanks again for tuning in. Until next time, stay safe, take care, and Jai Hind.